Welcome to Overcrest. I'm Chris, and Jake is not here, but Felix Holst is here. How's it going, man? What's going on in Felix land?
Oh, Chris, it's, yeah, man. Lots going, too much going on. Too much 405. Too much 405 freeways going on.
Oh, Jesus. What's 405? What do you mean? Is that like some?
That's the main like north-south fucking freeway that runs through Los Angeles. It's hell on wheels. Yeah. Oh, hell on concrete.
And nothing compared to Chicago. I went down to Chicago for 3 days with the wife. I was helping her out with a photo shoot. And dude, at least when you're in California, you're in California on the 405. So you're not in Illinois, right? Because like when you're in like downtown Chicago, it's pretty great. There's a lot of really beautiful architecture there. And it's kind of like this wonderful place, but anywhere else is terrible. But if you're driving around the 405, maybe you're going over to the beach, maybe you're going up to Ojai, maybe you're going up into the mountains. I don't know. It just seems like for some reason, baking in the sun in Chicago construction is way worse than the 405 any day.
It's something, I've been here nearly 20 years now, as you can tell by the accent.
You indiscernible before then.
Oh man, I was literally talking to someone the other day about that, and they were saying, "But you still sound so British." And I was like, "Yeah, but you know, I've had a few beers." Or imagine what I was like when I was fresh off the boat. I still say boat. I say boat. People are like, "What? Boat?"
Here's some like keywords. Say milk.
Milk.
What do you say for milk? Okay. What about roof?
Roof.
Roof. Like I get made fun of for saying roof. Like sometimes I'll say, "Hey, it's up on the roof, or on the roof," roof.
Everything's very, very double O, right? So like, book, hook, roof. Like people at work used to just take the piss. Anytime I said book or roof or hook, people were just like, in the Mattel days, they just used to fall about laughing. And quite often we'd be doing like, you know, some kind of like vehicle adventure playset that had a hook. Anytime I said hook. 40 people in the approval meeting would just fall about laughing, and it became such a running joke that like I had to really avoid words like hook.
Oh, you think after like the fourth or fifth time?
No, you know. You Americans, you fucking love it. You cannot.
Yeah. Well, have you seen Snatch?
Oh yeah, man. Like that is what's his face is Brad. That's Brad Pitt's greatest ever role. Like
that is phenomenal.
That like the fact that he did a Irish pikey accent better than most British actors could do it. Amongst some of the greatest accents in contemporary British cinema, by the way. And he just stole the fucking show. And it was so true to life. Like I actually, looking at your Merc back there, that's the European Merc, not the American Merc. I used to have one. I had a 69 that I used to tool around in Newcastle when I was a student. And I had a pikey backstreet garage, proper lock, stock, and two smoking barrels kind of guy who was a Mercedes expert. How this like pikey who lived in a caravan became a Mercedes expert, I have no idea. I'm assuming.
What is a pikey? What does that mean?
It's a certain kind of Irish traveler.
Okay.
And Irish travelers are kind of, I believe, descendants of the Romany folk. The gypsies, as we used to call them, although we don't call them gypsies anymore. And if you are familiar with, what the fuck was that? British Birmingham throwback gangster thing that was just very popular. Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, Peaky Blinders. Yeah. My wife loves that show because the main character is apparently very attractive.
But. Well, I love him. I would.
Yeah, he's good. Cheekbones
like that. Good lord.
Yeah, 28 Days Later is phenomenal movie.
Yeah, it's Cillian Murphy, man. He's fucking brilliant. Not just because he's gorgeous either.
He's a good looking man.
He's a good looking man. So like that's all Romany folk, right? That's all the kind of and I don't know, where do the Romanys come from? Romania, I guess, probably.
Makes sense.
And so they,
well, Rome. It could be Rome too, right?
Be Rome,
but then, they don't look very Italian.
They would drive Fiats and Alfa Romeos. So pikeys are the kind of like the Irish, I believe the Irish generational progression from the Romani. So they're traveling folk, generally scrap men and carnies. You would call them carnies here as well. They run traveling fairs. and they generally deal in scrap and possibly possibly weapons and all sorts of other things. lots of backstreet barefist fighting. I mean, you name the, like, you know, the underworld sport, and pikeys are right in the middle of it. You know, dog fights, cock fights, bare knuckle boxing, bareback horse riding. You name it, man, and you can.
Yeah, it sounds like a good, like, they know how to have a good time. Basically, is what you're
saying.
They know
how to have a really good time. You can't understand a word this year. You think my accent's bad? Then and Brad Pitt's accent in Snatch is very definitely, like, absolutely peak pikey. And they're
what's interesting about that movie is you don't really need to understand what he's saying to, understand what he's saying.
Oh, 100%.
You know? Like, you can just kind of figure it out.
No, it's a classic. I mean, honestly, I'm not taking the piss. He is utterly brilliant in that.
Yeah, I would say that have you seen The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford?
I haven't.
Dude, it is phenomenal. It's about this guy who's obsessed with Jesse James. Right. And everybody knows he gets assassinated. It's the real story of Jesse James or whatever, great American robber or criminal or whatever. And this Robert Ford character just, like, idolizes him. And it's all about, you know, obviously it's in the title, The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. But Brad Pitt, I mean, Snatch is good, but this movie... I mean, we're splitting hairs now because they're both good, but that is a phenomenal movie.
Can you imagine being known as, like, you're not the outlaw Jesse James, you're the coward?
Yeah.
Can you
imagine? The coward Robert Ford.
Your moniker is the coward. Hi, nice to meet you. What's your name? I'm the coward Felix Holst.
No, that doesn't sound good. I don't think.
It doesn't go down well, does it?
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's like a late-teen. I love Westerns. It's not a Western in the conventional sense of, you know, good versus bad and all this other, you know, robbing the stagecoach type shit. Although I do really love old spaghetti Westerns. They're great to just sit there and zone out to while you do social media work, is throw on, like, some shitty old spaghetti Western. And
do you know what I love? Like, taking a quick left turn based on that, as this conversation seems to be going. I love spaghetti Mad Max movies.
I've heard of, but have not seen.
There was a whole genre. Like, I am a Mad Max freak. Like, I watched the movies as soon as I could watch them on VHS when I was a kid. And I think the first two are, like, two of the greatest movies ever made. Like, that's just me. But
what do you think of the new one?
The new one was awesome. Yeah. I thought it was fucking spectacular. When you find out how many of those stunts were practical stunts and the after effects were really just coloration and a little bit of atmosphere added, it blows your mind because you're convinced in this day and age that they couldn't possibly shoot a movie the way they shot the original. And the thing that blew my mind about Road Warrior, the second movie, is that epic chase at the end was all, it's a one-shotter. Like, they shot that whole chase in one go. It wasn't like retake, let's go and crash the truck again. People got really seriously hurt in that sequence, and it's a one taker. They went and ran the whole chase live, and they had camera cars all over the place, dressed up as Mad Max cars, and people got really seriously hurt, and they just kept going. And when you know that, and you watch it again, no matter how many times you watch the movie, when you go back and watch it through that lens of, like, holy shit, they just went out and shot this as, like, a live chase.
Yeah,
it's like mind bending.
Yeah, that stuff's not allowed anymore. We had what's the movie with Charlie Sheen where he comes back to life and goes and chases after the dude that killed him in his Corvette?
Wraith.
Wraith. So we had the stunt driver, the main stunt driver on the podcast for the Wraith.
Right.
The guy that drove for Charlie Sheen, drove the Corvette, did these other things. And similar thing is they had this dually F-250. If I can find out, it's like 250 episodes ago. But a guy had never told this story before, but they had a Ford F-250 with a camera crew in the back, and they're just bombing around filming these cars, and the truck went off the cliff, killed everybody. Yeah, it killed everybody, and it changed the way that stunt driving was done forever.
Wow.
You know, that film changed everything. Nothing was ever filmed like that ever again.
That's amazing. I've never heard that story. I used to be in business with a bunch of stunt drivers. And obviously at the end of my Hot Wheels career, we hung out with a lot of stunt drivers, and I've heard a lot of stories. I've never heard that one. That's
interesting. That's breed, those guys. Oh, you know, we had Batman on, the guy that's in the new Batman movie.
Right.
It's those dudes are something else. I don't know. I don't know what it's like to be a retired stunt driver and what it's like to crawl out of bed in the morning, but it's got to sound like a box of marbles dropping on the floor with all your bones cracking and popping.
And there used to be a lot of cocaine involved. You know, used to be a lot of like, all right, get back in, do another line, get back in the car, roll it again. You know what I mean? Let's jump that generally another time today. How many times is that? Can't remember. Just do another line and let's hit the ramp in the right place.
I feel like the last good stunt driving movie was Death Proof. Death Proof. I don't know if you've seen that or not. God, I can't. Kurt Russell drives around that Chevy Nova. And I can't remember the name of the girl stunt driver that's on the Dodge Challenger or Charger or whatever it is. But those scenes are incredible.
Yeah.
They're some of the best stunt driving.
I've never had my heart in my mouth in any automotive scene more than when she's on the hood of the car.
Mm-hmm. With the belt.
And you're just waiting for something awful to happen. Yeah. And it doesn't happen. But like, spoiler alert, it doesn't happen. But I've never been more tense. And I watched it in the cinema. I've never been more tense in any like automotive carnage movie than in that movie.
Yeah, it was such, I mean, the whole movie is that scene, essentially, right? They set it up, and then the whole movie is that revenge scene or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, 25 minutes long of a car chase. There's nothing like it in cinema, nothing.
It's crazy.
Speaking of which, what do you define cinema? I got into an argument with a friend about this the other day. What do you define cinema as? Because we got in an argument of whether cinema can exist as something that's only viewed on a phone. You know, does cinema have to be at the theater? What do you think?
That's a pretty like live debate, isn't it? Really,
The way things are going, right? Like,
yeah,
you view cinema on a phone?
Well, let's put it this way, right? Take one of the great movies. Take The Italian Job, the original one. Truly great movie, right?
Yeah.
Mad Max, truly great movie. Absolutely cinema, right? Does it stop being cinema when you watch it on the TV? Or on your iPad? Even like, it's cinema, right? It's great cinema.
Or how many sensory experiences do you remove before it isn't? How many do you change?
Is cinema dependent on a big Dolby stereo system in a theater, or is it dependent on brilliant storytelling and wonderful visuals and directing? And so if you watch it on your phone, how much of the experience are you losing in the way that truly great cinema, which I would argue that truly great cinema is not reliant on, you know, truly great cinema was originally watched on a little clickety clackety reel to reel projector against a small screen, like quite often.
Yeah, but the expectations of those people were similar because it was the best there was, right? Mm-hmm. So the expectation of that in the theater, the clickety clack thing, was insane to those people.
Yeah.
Right? That just contrasts what they've never seen anything like it. It's nuts. And that, like, us going to a theater experience is kind of the contrast of watching it on a phone is also, there's a huge amount of breadth there too.
Yeah. I would argue that like watching, so I went to see, I took my daughter to see The Little Mermaid, the new one. And like, it's a fucking Disney movie. There's going to be a lot of effing in this.
That's okay. there's no FCC here.
it's a Disney movie. It's a massive budget, 2.5 hours long. Went to see it in the cinema. Incredible sound, incredible effects. I would not call it great cinema, right?
Well, is any Avengers movie or any of that stuff, is any of it cinema? I mean, someone said it was, and I can't remember who it was.
I don't know. I mean, I think when they're good, they're very, very good, to be honest. And I think that, like, those movies, I get completely overwhelmed by the amount of superhero movies there are now. And I was never a big action movie for the sake of action movie guy. But I think that when an Avengers movie is good, it's really good. There's a lot of filler movies amongst that in that whole like genre.
Yeah, for sure.
Because there's also a sliding scale of budgets across the board. But I think when you see like when they're good, they can be truly, truly epic. And some of the visual effects and design in those things are just incredible, right?
I feel like I'm being manipulated though, a little bit. Because there's so many, like, if you watch any of the newer Chris? Movies, there's so many cuts. It's like cut, 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 cut. You can't like take in a scene because you're constantly just like,
oh, I mean, I can't bear that shit. You know,
like, it's just too much.
Performance, man. Like, hang on a minute. What am I looking at? It's just a world of parts. Like,
yeah.
One thing
I do love about the cinema is the anonymity of enjoying something like that with a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Like, you're just in the sea of people all experiencing the same thing. You know, I There's something, unless someone's eating and throwing popcorn at you and munching loudly and crinkling their bag. Why do we give people bags that make noise at the theater? What are we doing?
As the bags have got bigger as well, you'd think we'd have developed some technology for cinema candy that doesn't rustle.
What are we doing? It's so terrible.
Dude, if I could figure out how to monetize that, I'd go and do it tomorrow. But, you know.
Someone's already on it. They just listen to this and they've just asked ChatGPT how to make a bag that doesn't crinkle. And it's already been programmed. The chemistry of it has already been figured out.
It's done.
So yeah. How's art, man? Last time we talked, you were auctioning things off in the range of the, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 thing. And now this Bring a Trailer hood, which is something that Mobile One did with you and in conjunction with Lufkikult and a few other artists, all incredibly talented people. Just, what was it, $35,000?
$35,000. Crazy shit, right?
Yeah. Why? Like, I mean, obviously you're an incredibly talented artist. That aside, what do you think it is that is driving that?
You know, it's a tough one, right? I think there's a certain, like, well, first things first, right? Like, I did very well. Jeff Bull, your very good friend, and now my very good friend, did very well. I think he did 20,000 on his.
Yeah.
And then we had Devante, who I thought, like, really brought the fire when it came to his kind of, you know, graffiti, calligraphy, interpretation of race stripes.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
He topped out at a couple of grand, $2,500. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a thing with art, and we always say it, right? You don't buy the art, you buy the artist. And
but Jeff was unknown.
Well, to a certain extent. To a certain extent. But I think one of the things that Jeff did, Jeff's a marketeer, right? Like he's and one of the things he did brilliantly was he just brought the slogan. And then also he also put on, you know, he did a great job of branding his like kilo piece. And so I think that within that Porsche world, the people who know, right? And so to have an original piece by Jeff, which had his drugs, graphic, and also a lot of other really cool, it was a nice piece, you know. So I think that if you know that sticker has been seen on enough cool guys cars over time for the Porsche crowd to know Jeff's work and know the brand,
right?
I've certainly kind of built up, God knows how, because my Porsche has been off the road now for 10 years and it's still nowhere near getting back on the road, but I've built up a bit of a rep in that world. And I think that's part of it. I think, and then of course it was for charity, and the Ken Block 43 Institute's a great cause for a great guy. Mobile One, you know, Lufkikult, live painting at Lufkikult. I think all of those things probably, and everybody loves to, you know, dig deep and give to charity, especially in the very competitive bidding world of Bring a Trailer. Everyone loves to give more than the next guy, in the same way that everybody loves more for their car than the next guy. Sure. I think it's a combination of things. I've got a piece on the board right now that I've been struggling with for months, and it's a commission work, and I kind of lost my way a little bit, especially now that I've kind of gone back to work full time. I haven't had as much time to sit and ponder my navel when it comes to artistic concepts, I guess.
I can't see mine anymore.
But I just, like, I went at that piece. I wanted to do something that was redolent of my style, and my style takes months. So to do something in 6 hours, I had to really plan it, but I also had to, like, let go a little bit and just be very, like, you know, Banksy graffiti rather than Felix Holst slaving over a canvas.
Did you struggle with that at all at the time? Were you frustrated with what you were doing? Was it hard?
I mean, by the end of it, I couldn't see it anymore, and it didn't. One of the things that I thought I'd planned it very well, but one of the things that I hadn't planned for was it was cold. And so the paint didn't dry quickly. And acrylic paint normally dries really quick. Well, if you live in Southern California, it dries really quick. And so painting on a cold metal hood, that first coat, and I wanted to change the color completely. I didn't want to just paint on the primer. So I had to do a full color coat on the hood, and it took forever to dry. And then when I came to paint the actual red of the car and try and do a fade, like from like highlight to low light on the red of the car, it wouldn't blend properly. It was very smudgy. So at that point, I really had to just like loosen up and go with it and just be like, fuck it. This is literally like graffiti.
Yeah. Would you do it again? Did you learn anything from that? Did you enjoy the result of it not being what you wanted it to be?
Well,
and letting that go.
It gave me two things, right? It made me realize that I could paint far looser and still produce stuff that people want. And in fact, maybe perhaps the looser I am, the more exciting it is to people. Also the very bold graphic nature of it, made me get back to really what my roots are instead of trying to be, I've been working over the past year to trying to be a better painter, like to be more, like more realism, more accuracy. And then I realized,
are you talking about like proportions and things like that?
More to do with rendering, more to do with like, how do you make chrome look just chrome enough without it overtaking the whole painting? Anyone who's ever learned about car design and rendering, you understand how subtle the fades are to make a car look solid and shiny. And it's about very, very, very subtle fades from light to dark in the color of the car.
Yeah.
That's very difficult to do with acrylic paint. Acrylic paint dries so quick that there are techniques you have to build to be able to do a blend from like dark blue to almost white without there being any streaks. Because if you get any streaks, then it makes the car look like it's got dents on it. So it has to be an absolutely perfect blend. Now, what I produced at Lufkehol, I couldn't do that. I just had to go and throw paint at the fucking thing and use the stencil and dribble paint and make it dynamic. And then I also put that big yellow arrow on it, which is very, I'm reclaiming my arrow from Magnus, I think. That's part of it. I sprayed an arrow on the side of my hot rod last weekend, a yellow arrow at that.
All right.
Like the arrow's all, I'm all about the arrow. And I put an arrow, I can actually like walk over and show you this painting in a moment. It's all I've got to do is pick the computer up and walk across the studio. So it gave me a good kick in the pants. And it kind of gave me a bit more of a, it got me back in touch with more of the punk rock side of me when it comes to art and a little bit more
not give a fuck. Let's just do this.
Just do it. And I think that the reaction at the show was great. But I was a bit too in the zone to really enjoy it then. I mean, we didn't see actual Lufkehol at all. Like,
right. Yeah. You guys just stood there the whole day. There
7 hours, basically.
It was a great show, man. It was really good.
Great. I'm glad that they did I'm glad they did Air and Water. The Air and Water was fucking awesome as well. I mean, I'm glad that I'm glad I hung around. If I hadn't hung around, I wouldn't have got to do the awesome kind of couch time with you talking shit for 4 hours. On the Lufkehol come down. I managed to galvanize some friendships and also reconnect with a lot of people I hadn't seen for a long time. So it was a phenomenal weekend. But then also it meant that I was gonna just go home the end of that day. And
I remember that. Yeah.
You know, we did the Joshy Robots crazy biker bar adventure that night and and then got to go and see Air and Water the next morning, and then like I got to hang out with Zwart for a little bit, and my buddy someone who's become quite a good friend of mine, Diego Rodriguez, who was at some point the head of IDEO North America, right? And IDEO is like this enormous industrial design company.
Okay.
And Diego, who is like kind of semi-retired now, he was parking cars under Zwart's direction, like just as an experience. He'd volunteered, right? So the next day I got to hang out with Diego, and he was like showing me all of the kind of like the things that he was in the know on, the best angles and how they curated the whole thing, and also just a much younger crowd, you know, because of all the water cool cars. A lot of those cars are more affordable, and so it's just a different generation of less kind of, I mean, air-cooled 911 world, air-cooled Porsche world's cool, right? Because there's something for everybody. If you want to be punk rock, you can be punk rock still. Even with the prices rising, you can still be a rebel. You can still be punk as fuck.
If you got the guts.
If you got the guts, you can still do it. If you're Joshy, you can still do it. As long as you can afford to put what used to be a quick $5,000 engine in the back of your car when you blew it up, it's now a $25,000 engine, which is a bit, that running like that's a bit harder now in Porsche world.
It is. Yeah, I just rebuilt my motor and I still beat the fuck out of it, you know, but I think about it more than I ever did before.
Yeah, it's a lot more time off-road. If you blow the thing, it's a lot more, unless you're wealthy, it's a lot more time in the garage, isn't it? Like waiting.
Well, it's just time. I mean, I don't care how much money you have. Machine shop is a machine shop. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Get in line.
and they're closing down all the time as well. I've got one of my bosses, Zach Dunn, is trying to. These are rocket engineers. We'll come to that in a bit. But he's decided he wants to build his own Porsche motor for his. He's got a 70, like a all original 70, and he was like, you know, he's like a brilliant engineer. Strips his motor down himself, documents everything, and then can't find anybody to do the machine work. Like in SoCal, he's like, dude, it's like a 6 month to a year wait to get your machine work done.
Yeah, there was a friend of mine had his heads done, and he gets his heads back, and the wrong size length valves are in it. And then another guy was working with the same machine shop, and they said, sorry, man, we just let our guy that does our heads, we let him go. Jesus. And so they sent him his heads back in the mail. This is like a big shop that everybody would know. And I'm just like, holy shit, where are people going to go now?
Yeah.
It's I don't know if it's just like no one wants to learn. And there's nobody absorbing the knowledge from these dudes that know how to do it. I don't understand.
I think there's a little bit of both. These guys who are done, like they're not gonna hang around waiting for someone to come and train. When you're done, you're done, you know. When you're old or when you're retired or when you want to move on and you're bored, right? You're not gonna sit around waiting for an apprentice to turn up before you can leave.
It's all timing.
And then the lad who lives next door to me, Will, he's 17, 18, maybe 19. And he's brain dead car nut, right? And he's the kid who is out there every night fixing his race car. Like, and he wants to learn. But he comes and looks at my 32 Ford and it's completely alien to him, you know? He's just like, oh, dude, you need to put electronic ignition on that because that's just, what the fuck's that? And looking at distributed.
Of course, let's talk about our sponsor, Petrolbox. Petrolbox is a monthly service made specifically for the automotive enthusiast. May that be you or a car guy, car girl in your life. Makes a great gift, as I always say. Each and every month, they carefully select items from the industry, be it garage gear, tools, apparel. Usually you always get a t-shirt. You always get some really cool, unique enamel pins. And then detailing supplies almost every month. You get detailing supplies along with a tool that goes with the detailing supplies in addition to some other either gadget or like innovation in the garage or in the automotive industry, I guess is the best way to say it. So really cool. Every single month is unique. It's an awesome, if you've ever done any sort of subscription service, this is, I think, one of the most fun for myself. And I think a lot of our listeners who are definitely into cars and automotive culture. So check those guys out at mypetrolbox.com. Subscriptions start as low as $19.95 a month. You can also get the Petrolbox Premium, which is even more gear for $39.95 a month. And if you are going to do that, please use the code Overcrest because that'll get you $6 off your order. All right. That's mypetrolbox.com. Check him out.
Phone and the world ended. So it's just like total collapse. Sorry about the technical thing there. What were we talking about?
Technology. I was just about to say, we were talking about like where are all the machinists going and all. Is there a future or is this it? And I think that like, I don't think they're all going, but I think it's very difficult for small shops to find people because like I work in a factory that's full of really brilliant machinists, all of whom are interested in things like cars and rockets. But when you talk to your average kid in the street who has grown up on Hondas and he has a look in any of the engines in my car, he's just like, whoa, dude, what the fuck's that? And it's like, it's a carburetor, dude. And it's like, oh my god, that looks difficult. I just plug things in and it tells me what's wrong, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's a disconnect between where these smaller shops can actually find people, you know. And I love, you know, you look at things like Wiretech and stuff and these like trade colleges. But I just wonder that I don't want to be that guy at the age of 50 going like, but
damn kids.
There's a work ethic thing with these kids. But there kind of is a work ethic thing with these kids. Not all of them at all. But there is more than ever before, there's like an instant gratification thing that's been fed to at least one generation, maybe two, that if it's not immediate and it's not slick and easy, then it's not worth doing, you know? And so I think it's just all of these things are piling up to make it harder and harder for that local Porsche shop or Mercedes shop to find a really good quality machinist who knows. Well,
a really good quality machinist is a craftsman, and craftsmanship takes time.
Yeah.
And you're going to fail a lot.
Yeah.
You're going to break a lot of shit. Stuff's not going to work right for probably years. You're going to fuck up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. I mean, the instant gratification thing is hard because I remember this is my first thought when I realized what was happening. All right. So I was at H2O, which is a Volkswagen car show out on the East Coast. It was huge. It was Ocean City. The whole city would be taken over by thousands and thousands of Volkswagens. It was a killer show. And then one year, two things happened. You started seeing blow up dolls sticking out of sunroofs showing up on social media. All right. So we're talking about the instant attention and doing things for not the attention of I'm going to build a car and this car is going to win. I want to impress people with the quality and the craftsmanship and the ideas for this car.
Yeah.
Instead we went from that to the blow up doll out the sunroof.
Dumb shit.
Yep. And then we went to guys doing as much camber as they possibly could, which meant shoving a bolt behind your hub on the bottom side of your hub so you could get, you know, 2-3 degrees of camber on your Rabbit.
Yep.
You know, and then people pushing the envelope that way because it shocked people. And just like Fox News, CNN, whatever, they want to shock people too. It's like the car version of that. It's a very simple chemical reaction in people's brains. They don't show people getting kittens out of trees on the news. That's not what they show.
No. To be honest, it's to me in some ways, and as I'm saying this, I'm now grinding my gears back through the annals of car culture history, but it's almost, it's amazing that it took this long. And maybe it literally took everybody to have a decent camera in their pocket and that's what did it, you know? But like, I guess when you look at Ed Roth, and the show cars of the 60s, those cars were built as like, they were big crowd draws. You went to see Ed Roth's latest fucking whacked out.
Yeah, it was a monument.
Yeah. And it's the same thing, right? Those cars, there was no intention to like take it seriously. It was about shock and awe. But at the same time, it was about crafts. It was artists. It was craftsmanship being recognized for being able to do something that nobody else could do. And that's what, so I guess at the end of the day, the trend was shock and awe, but the aim was to win a trophy.
Yeah, the execution was different. I haven't heard anything about the Riddler event in a long time, you know, where the best of the best shows up or whatever. You know about the Riddler? Yeah,
I don't know whether that is it being sucked into the Grand National Roadster show now, or is it still
a separate? I have no idea.
I used to know, like if you'd asked me that 10 years ago, I would have told you exactly what was up with the Riddler.
Yeah, like what happened? You know, that's what I'm saying. Like that whole thing where I would go to see a car that was being built for the Riddler event and I had to sign an NDA before I could even walk through the door.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist now because everybody, how do you get social media clout if everybody that sees what you're doing has to sign an NDA before they walk in the door? Nah, you want them to be taking pictures of stuff. And I think it's, you know, I think of, the art, the drawing of the guy staring into the pool of water. You know, when you look up narcissism on Wikipedia, it's a guy looking and we're all, I mean, at this point, I think anybody that uses social media is guilty of it to some point. But if you can't see your own reflection when you're doing stuff anymore, it's almost like it doesn't matter.
The Riddler.
Oh, you just look.
It's now sponsored by Meguiar's.
Okay.
It's now an award that is featured at the Detroit Autorama, March 1st to 3rd, 2024. So the Riddler Award is obviously like the award that is being either pimped out or sold out to whatever show wants to pay for it.
Right.
It's my assumption.
Detroit Autorama.
Yeah. Wow. From two Google headlines, I'm assuming it's become somebody owns it. And they will sell it to the highest bidder, depending on what show wants to feature the Riddler Award. Whereas my understanding was was the Riddler not always up in Oakland?
I'm not sure where it was. All I know is that the Riddler made cars at SEMA look like the Matchbox cars I run over in my driveway.
Yeah.
You know, there's some pretty crazy stuff. Anyway, so I want to talk a little bit about, and this is something I don't know if a lot of people know about you, and we talked a little bit about this at the Lufka Cult house when we were hanging out on the couch, is leadership. And I want to know what, before we get into it too much, what is your definition of leadership? Like, what is it? Like, what does it mean when we say leadership? And that's like one of your main roles. And how do you apply leadership to what you do?
That's an interesting one, right? To set the tone, I've just taken a leadership role in a rocket company, and I am not a rocket scientist, that's for sure.
You should just say you are, though. I mean, I would.
I tell everybody I'm a space cadet. Exactly, the lowest. I'm learning, but not very quickly. The big thing for me was I spent a lot of years doing very well with Hot Wheels as a leader.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And when I left Hot Wheels, my ego took a huge ding, because it was I'd let the whole thing become too much for me, really. I'd allowed too much of myself to become the brand and vice versa. And so I lost a lot of confidence as a leader, because I assumed that I was good because I was a subject expert. Being at Relativity Space has made me realize that all I've got to be is passionate about the subject, because it's the processes that I apply and the way that I think about making mission, let's say, getting the job done, that is what makes me a leader rather than just a creator. And I think leadership, there's many, many different forms of leadership, right? But leadership is about looking at the resources and the people at your disposal and getting the job done. If you have to take one person on a journey to get a job done, then you're the one who is pointing the path forward and showing them how to get there and ensuring that it happens, then yes, I guess you're a leader, right? And the thing that I put above all other things now is the notion of people and process is what I really believe in, right? I don't need to be the expert. I don't need to understand even how the thing that we're building works. But what I need to understand is all of the pieces on the game board and how we play the game to win. And the thing that I've really come to realize as I get older, because yes, folks, I'm not anymore. I'm 15. I realize that experience, again, like talking about my friend Diego, who used to run IDEO. We the first time I met him, we'd both just decided to grow beards, and I'd never met him in person before. So we sat down for lunch in Silicon Valley, and we both had grown these like stubbly gray beards, and we were bemoaning the fact that we were not young men anymore. And then in discussion, we realized that the common thread is that where gray beard used to be a bit of a derogatory term, and it tended to talk about people who were a little bit out of touch and living in the past. Now, when you look at these companies and you work in these big tech companies and you realize how young the workforce is who are doing these never been done before things, right? Yes, we've launched rockets before.
Yeah.
But we've never, you know, our mission at the moment is from blank sheet to first launch of a reusable rocket in like just over 3 years, right? That's never been done.
How do they deal with the pressure of that? Man, that's got to be... Being young and having that kind of are they too naive to understand the pressure? Like, what's the, you know?
I tend to think these kids have never known pressure, and so they just don't know what to call for them. I think that the thing about it is there's also a confidence that comes with being of that generation where technology is your friend. You've got so many tools at your disposal that we used to have to we used to have to learn tools for years just to move forward in what we could do. Whereas there's so much power in modern analytical equipment, analytical tools, design tools. We're printing rockets, right? So you look at how fast we can print things now versus 10 years ago. It's wild. And I think there's and then also there's a lot of, you know, I call them young, but at the end of the day, there's a lot of them are in their 30s. And they've already been through Blue Origin or SpaceX or, you know, another rocket or satellite startup. They've already got a very thrilling career behind them working for companies that have changed the world. And so there's certainly a confidence there that they kind of know what they're doing. And I just can't get used to the idea that this whole company is like the you know, I'm literally one of the very oldest people at the company. But what I realize is that the thing that you don't learn, you can't learn, no matter where you study, no matter how good you become with your chosen skill and profession, the thing that you can't learn is experience with people. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I've learned over time is that if you fix the people and you fix the relationships with the people, then everything else kind of falls into place. If you try to fix people with process or a blunt instrument, it generally doesn't go well. But to really fix people, to really build process, you've got to be kind of selfless. You've got to put yourself in the back seat and you've got to really believe in those people and that process.
How are you able to let go? I mean, that in terms of, you know, Overcrest is very small and some of the other ventures I've done are all very small. But one thing that I personally have trouble with is letting go and trusting, you know, being trusting of others. And because there's stakes, things are at stake, right? And you want it to be like this or whatever. How do you let go, man? That's tough. That's really hard.
I think I'm just fundamentally lazy. I'm more than happy to let somebody else do the work. Felix's management 101. Give into your own self, your laziness. Give into your laziness and let somebody else do the work. But the thing about it is, right, I've had experiences, like my Hot Wheels experience was like really over spread over 20 years. And several times in that 20 years, I had to learn to let go and realize that if I wanted to grow and actually earn more money and be responsible for more, I couldn't actually do it all myself. And so mm-hmm. I had to learn to delegate, right? That was one of the biggest skills on my path to management and to being a good leader was understanding delegation. And I guess there's a little bit of luck in that, right? That I had good experiences in my early days of delegation, it paid dividends. And so I became an early adopter, or I learned to love delegation very quickly because I saw how much more powerful it could be.
And even then when it burns you, because it does, right?
Of course it does. But like, I think one of the things that, I'm an awful person, right? Because the next thing I'm going to talk about is my ego, right? That I always wanted to do bigger and better. And that was very ego driven. So I'm a lazy, egotistical fucking maniac. Within that, it taught me how to let go of things so that I could do bigger things, right? Okay, I've done this now. I'm going to let these people do the thing that I've set up. And now I'm going to go and do the next biggest thing.
Yeah.
That carried me through Hot Wheels. But then when the time came for me to walk away from that, I was deeply damaged because I found it very, very hard to let go of a brand that had not only meant a lot to me as a kid, but it also defined my career, right? It had defined me as an executive. And it was the best job in the world for quite a period of time. I mean, fucking amazing to be the head of design.
Like, who were you really in your own head when you left, right? Like, who?
I honestly didn't know, right? And, and also, the other interesting thing was this was when I left, like, things like social media and Instagram were really still just beginning to be kind of significant.
Yeah.
So not like I'd ever had the chance to learn how to be a persona outside. My only persona was in those realms. The only time I got to build a brand for myself was actually on the back of what I did every day, which was Hot Wheels. Because, and also in the final year of that, when Instagram had started taking off, Mattel also would not let you do anything. Like, they used to have these very, very archaic kind of IP rules that were very damaging to the creative industry. They've changed them since, thank God. But if you were a creative working for Hot Wheels, you had to have their Mattel's permission to do anything else creative in the world because they believed that they owned you. They owned your
own. Is that common outside? I mean, that seems, is that just like an old school way of doing it generally, not just Mattel, but other industries that...
Yeah, it's very, but companies were beginning to learn. Mattel were a little bit slow in learning. You know, Disney had given up on trying to protect Mickey Mouse and were then handing it out to kind of, you know, graffiti artists and vinyl collectible companies to like bastardize and Minnie, and Lucas had done the same thing with Star Wars, right? And they'd reap the benefits, to be honest, of a far broader audience by allowing their IP to be what's the word I'm looking for? Like
just flexible, not holding on so tight.
Yeah, deconstructed and reimagined by a new generation, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Hot Wheels have done, they've done a lot better than that since I left. But those final years, like, Instagram was around, but I couldn't post anything. I couldn't really, you know, and I wasn't painting at the time because I realized recently the reason I didn't paint anything in my time at Hot Wheels was because I couldn't be bothered with the politics of, like, trying to convince them that Felix Holst, head of Hot Wheels, selling paintings wasn't related to the fact that I was head of Hot Wheels, which of course it was, but I mean, it still is. I don't, here we are talking about it, but I don't go around promoting myself as the ex-head of Hot Wheels, but like bring a trailer, open every single auction with Felix Holst is the ex-head of Hot Wheels. Yeah. I'm not complaining because I really do believe that like puts a bit of a premium on my work. But I didn't build a, when I was at Hot Wheels, I did a lot of kind of, you know, I did a lot of the marketing events and I did it, you know, I was a judge on a TV show and things, but nowhere near what I would expect the designers now can actually do with their own brands without getting into trouble with Mattel, you know? So leaving Hot Wheels, I hadn't actually managed to create an identity in the world that I love, which is like horrible, smelly old cars and art. Yeah. I hadn't really built an identity outside of that. And so I found it very tough to walk away from Hot Wheels and figure out who was I now in this world that I love. And it took me quite a while. And then through Hack Rod, those years were good for me because I realized that I could still hold my head up as a design leader and a conceptual leader in technology and automotive. And I could actually, like, you know, work with people like Siemens, Toyota and all of these big companies and actually still be a really great project leader and visionary.
All right, guys, I am going to unfortunately interrupt our amazing interview here for 1 second, but don't worry because I'm going to talk about something really cool as well. Our sponsor, Automotive Anonymous. You've heard of me talk about these guys for a few weeks now. It is an awesome online store for motorsport collectibles. It started out as kind of just a personal collection, and it's turned into kind of this curated, amazing store of vintage automotive posters and collectibles. There's a lot of Porsche stuff, but of course, it's kind of, it runs the gamut. I always like to just kind of pull up their site here and pick a product and just kind of give you a flavor of what you can find here. Or if you are not lazy, just go to autoanon.com. Let's see. We have, I love the vintage posters. Of course, they have enamel pins and collectibles. They also have vintage pins too. Those are cool. Okay, so what do we got here? Grand Prix. This is a 1985 original poster. I should mention that all of the posters on their site are originals. This isn't some guy on eBay who's just like making photocopies and selling. No, these are actually original. This one is a 1985 Nürburgring Grand Prix Strecke. Very cool. Oh, this is a fully German ad too. It's very cool. What do we have there? We have the Jägermeister 962, I believe that is, along with the Blancpunk 962. Oh, Trek Race. We got the, like, the old Mann racing trucks, whatever they are. This is really cool, and it's all inside an Opel steering wheel for some reason. Gosh, I may have to buy this one. And it, what I love about this site, too, is you can find some of these posters are extremely collectible. And he does a really good job pricing them, honestly. I know that for a fact. But like this one, it's less than $60 for an original, awesome, historical motorsport poster. And they have everything, you know, Porsche, they got Indy cars, Formula One, of course, some Audi stuff. What is this? Is this another Opel or a Renault? No, that's an Opel. Oh, that's just cool. This is a 1985 Opel rally car with the actual rally stage map on it, too. You'll check that out. That's for $50 on the site as well. Yeah, he also posts quite a bit over on his Instagram at Automotive Anonymous. As I mentioned, all posters are original. There's extremely rare pieces and some that are affordable and awesome. And they're authentic, of course. You can use the code OVERCREST to get free shipping on any and all of these posters. And I kind of was chatting with the owner last week, and one thing I do love is the deep research he puts into valuing these rare posters. So like I said, he's very honest about valuing them because some of them are extremely valuable. But it's super cool. I want you guys to head over to autoanon.com automotiveanonymous.com or just on Instagram, Automotive Anonymous. Check it out. Check out some cool things. These would make great gifts as well, especially like an old Audi Quattro here. Maybe you know someone with an old Audi Quattro, can't figure out a gift for them. This would be really cool to have a vintage period correct poster that you could then give them. Ooh, I have a soft spot for 924s. So here's the 924 original 1977 showroom advertising poster where it's the cutaway in the illustrated style showing everything. That's really cool. You are sure I'm going to, if you head over there, I'm sure you're going to find stuff that you like. So please do that. AutoAnon.com.
Did you know that would save you?
No, I mean,
you know what I mean? Like if you were lost leaving Hot Wheels without knowing your identity and who you were, I mean, it seems like something like Hack Rod came around and was like salvation almost.
I think it was inevitable that I would do something stupid based on ego, you know, yeah. To try and say, I'll show you. I want to be in the future, not the past, which is really what it was all about. I didn't want to be in the kind of manufacturing junk in China model anymore, right? Like, right. We were putting less and less in boxes, and I was just like, I don't feel proud of these plastic toys. I'm always proud and still very proud of the team who produce the Hot Wheels cars, right? I think that still, I know the love and attention that goes into every single one of those, and to be able to buy those for like a dollar and a quarter or whatever they are now,
it's crazy,
mind-blowing, right? And there are, I have some very, very best friends who still work as designers for Hot Wheels, and I, you know, if anyone's ever going to go and vouch for that team outside of their own leadership, then I will vouch for them. Like, brilliant. But when it came to, like, you know, the basic play sets, like toy fire stations and garages and things, I just was like, I don't want to give this to my kid. There's just not enough in the box anymore for $10. You know? So the Hack Rod thing was, I wanted to be in cars. I wanted to be relevant, but I also didn't want to be in the past. And I wanted to be in tech. And I kind of think that I knew, I had to have conversations with way too many 50-year-olds as I fired them for being too old. Hmm. Like, sorry, dude, you're at a level now where you're very expensive, and I've been told by the company that I've got to lose 5% of the workforce, and I can either fire you or I can fire two of the young guys. And that's just the way corporate – that's not Mattel specific. That's just the way corporate life works or has worked. And I could see it. I was like, and then when I started seeing like really, really decorated veterans who were fucking brilliant, experienced executives also being shown the door because, you know, very expensive people. And when you start seeing that kind of like knowledge being shown out the door in exchange for cost saving, then to me, that whole thing was just a death spiral. And I didn't want to be the guy who was waiting at some point for them to realize I didn't know what I was doing anymore.
Right. Just waiting for that guillotine.
Yeah. And at the same time, it was when all of these kind of, you know, additive manufacturing, 3D print, like making, manufacturing with 3D printing, artificial intelligence, machine learning, all of these things were coming down the pipe.
When did you know they were coming down? Like, what, like, compared to where we are now? Like, for me, I go, oh, shit. Whoa, what's going on? It seems like in the last year for me, as someone that doesn't really pay attention to AI or 3D printing that much. When did you know it was coming?
10 years ago.
No shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Not so much. Yeah, 10 years ago. So we used 3D printing for prototyping at Hot Wheels for years. Years, years, years. All the way back to the late 90s.
As it's known today, like the same style of like, was what kind of, are we talking?
Stereo. So the early machines that we use were stereolithography, where you have a bath of resin and you have a platform that drops down it by a millimeter at a time, and the laser seals the resin. You know.
Yep.
And at the time, they were very crude. The material wasn't very strong. You could really only use it for very basic prototyping. And then over time, you know, it got better and better. We introduced when I was with Matchbox at Mattel, like, so when I came back to the States, I ran Matchbox for a couple of years before I got moved up onto the big brand. And so I had this scrappy young team of designers, Ryo Asada, who is sadly no longer with us, but was one of the great, I still rank Ryo Asada as, I think he's the greatest Hot Wheels designer of all time because of how much he did for process rather than just flamboyant designs. But he piloted digital design at his desk. And then we would prototype the cars with stereolithography over, like literally, the kind of like overnight. And so instead of having this whole very like time, this very like long-winded process of working with China model makers who would hand carve things and they would send back to the States and we'd approve it, we suddenly realized that we could actually get a good idea of proportion like overnight by 3D printing. And this is back in, by this point, it was like 2004, 2005.
Did you see this as something that was going to just start infecting everything? I don't want to say infect as a, or like being proliferated into everything.
It took me a while. I had to see, what did I see? What was the first thing I saw? I saw something somewhere that was, I'm going to say it was Ford. And they had, it was the first time I'd ever seen like a metal print. And it was very crude, but they were printing complex manifolds in metal. No, they were prototyping, but the prototype was such good quality, they could actually run it on an engine for a short period of time to figure out whether the fluid dynamics were working.
When is this, circa when, do you think?
I got to say it was around 20, I want to say like 2010, 2011, something like that.
Okay. Why haven't we seen more procedural, or is it computing power that we haven't seen more things like Singer, or I don't mean Singer, I mean Zinger, or however you say it, I'm not sure. Why haven't we seen more of that style of engineering if they've been doing it for that long? If they've had the technology to make parts and make things, why aren't we seeing more of it on a production level?
It's been a very, very rapid ramp up, to be honest. They had, theoretically, they could do it. They had very small machines making very small parts. One of the reasons that our designs at Hackrod fell by the wayside was we could create incredibly complex structures with generative engineering, but we could not print that complexity. Kevin Zinger, I met him years and years ago when we were in the same orbit at the time. And he at first had this like somewhat convoluted system of like, it was kind of like erector sets where he was 3D printing nodes and then using carbon fiber tubes to build like a flexible in terms of easy to change and upgrade chassis for his board. But then very rapidly and this was at a time when the only thing that you could really 3D print structurally in with powder bed was probably about that big. I have got very small hands, by the way, to put that into context. he can extrapolate this the way the industry's gone. He then stayed on that, and gradually the parts you could print got bigger and bigger, and the quality got better, and then you could actually weld parts together. So powder bed allows you to do very, very complex metal parts. One of the problems with it doesn't work like resin. You've got to have structures holding up. Not just holding up overhangs, but also acting as a heat sink, because it's welding basically.
This is all aluminum, silicon, magnesium velocity stacks and intake manifolds on there. And I could see where things were like cut off.
Yeah.
You know, I could see it. And the first design of that was printed in two pieces and then welded together.
Yeah.
And that didn't work out, but.
There was an amazing. You'll love this. Actually, you're a Mark One Volkswagen guy. There was an amazing VW Caddy produced by a subsidiary of Airbus in about 2016. I want to say maybe 2017, where they basically used generative engineering to completely reimagine the structure for the front of the car, and they 3D printed it with powder bed. And welded it together into this crazy skeletal structure. That replaced all of the structure in the front of this VW Caddy.
Airbus, the aviation company.
Yeah, yeah.
They're making a Caddy. Someone in that engineering team is pretty dope.
Yeah, someone. I would love to know who chose the Caddy. It's fucking wild.
Yeah, come on, man.
It was not just a Caddy as well. I think it had like Ronal turbos on it, and it was lowered, and it was like. I would love to know where that car is now. You know what I mean? It's like, it's dope.
It's sitting in a hangar somewhere. I guarantee it. Just collecting dust.
Just be under a sheet. So that was like, and then Kevin Singer has been doing that where they're printing some of the parts. I'm assuming are actually welded together because we're playing with the biggest powder bed machines on the planet at the moment, and we can't build parts quite the size of some of the stuff I've seen from Singer. So I'm assuming they're still welding parts together.
Right.
There's different types of it, right? So we're working on like what's called WAM. It's basically like wire, like it's to put it in real simple terms, It's a MIG welder on a robot arm that lays metal down.
Right.
And we're working on, like, we had our first launch in March, and we successfully got a fully 3D printed metal rocket to space.
Wow.
It was a legit rocket, you know. We had an ignition failure on the second stage, so we didn't quite get the payload to orbit, but we did put it well and truly in space, do the stage separation out of a 3D printed metal rocket.
Are you guys using AI at all with the 3D printing and the designs, or is that something that's getting, because from a regular dude perspective, it's me going to ChatGPT and going, what's the average penis size of the average American? You know, that's what I'm doing with AI. But what are someone like you doing, or your company? What are you guys doing with AI to help make the design better? Is it happening yet?
Very, very slowly, right? Generative design is a form of AI in a way that it's massive computational power that allows it to process, you know, vast amounts of data in the way that a neural link would do it, like a neural network would do it. Not true AI. It's not sentient. It's not thinking for itself. It's not, you know, but generative algorithms are used. Some of the engineers use them for you can get a sense check on whether your gut is telling you the structure's correct. We're a little way off. Some companies are using generative, like Zynger, are using generative to create engineering solutions and then manufacture them with 3D printing. We are hesitant to use it because you've got to bring the skill set up with the technology, and we're still very, very focused on ensuring that our print technology is actually world-beating. And then you've got limitations in terms of the geometry that the AI wants to build versus what you can actually print.
Right.
Anybody who works in this world understands this philosophy and this problem. But I think that over time, you know, I literally had lunch with some of the younger engineers today. I kind of do a once a month lunch just to kind of chat with them and see what's going on and blah, blah, blah. And I was just explaining what we did with Hackrod, where the vision was like, all right, I'm going to build a sports car, and it's going to have Corvette suspension geometry, and it's going to have a Tesla motor, and it's going to have a spine full of Nissan Leaf batteries, and it's going to be two-seater, engine's going to be in the back, and this is the shape of the body that I want. And then generative AI would basically engineer a chassis that would connect all of those important points. They would connect the geometric points of the suspension pickups.
Right.
Would connect the front to the back. It would provide enough support for the volume and mass of the Tesla engine.
Do you have to give it all the variables of the equipment they're installing on the car? Does it have to know that, or does it get it from somewhere?
Eventually, it would just get it from somewhere. You'd say Tesla engine. Just go and search and find the dimensions and the mass and the pickup points. And this was always for us, and we're going back, it's a few years since I was doing this now, but this was always the thing where we knew it would happen eventually. There's a theory in design called adjacent possibility, right? Or adjacent opportunity. And it's the idea that if you're in a room and it's got doors, it's four walls, four doors, and you can step through into the next room and like experience that next room, but you can't miss that room out. If you try to go from one room to the other, it's not possible. You've got to go from room to room. You open a door, step into the next room, right? So innovation is very similar to that. Where a lot of really brilliant ideas fall down is because they're just a little bit ahead of the adjacent opportunity. The adjacent opportunity is what is technology just about to let you do? And can you come up with an idea that's ready at the same time as that technology catches up, or right? If you try to go too far ahead, you fall off the edge of off the edge of the cliff. And we did that really. We had a lot of like futurism in our brains about what was about to happen, right? We knew that machine learning, which is another kind of like division of artificial intelligence, eventually you'd be able to say, all right, I want a Ford Fiesta pedal box and I want a Corvette suspension, and it would go and find the data. It would know the geometry, the pickup points, the dimensions. It would know the stresses needed. It would have the force data. And so true machine learning in that sense would come and give you an AI system. And then using a generative algorithm, you could optimize a structure that would hold it all together to be strong enough, and it, because it would understand the weights, the performance potential, how much force does the suspension pickup points need to go through to be this type of car or that type of car. And we did a lot of work on, like, could you get, is it possible to take something like Gran Turismo or Forza and have millions of users going around the same racetrack and mining data from that to know what's the performance envelope of any car,
right?
In effect, give it to the gaming world to generate the data to come back and then drop.
So when I think of the cars that I love, almost every reason of, obviously I love cars that are fast and stuff like that, but the things that define a car are usually flaws. Like if you look at the 911, it's the rear engine. It's weird, right? It's one of the defining moments of it. You think of some of the Volkswagen Rabbit stuff. It's a front wheel drive car. It's the first hot hatchback. It's hamstrung by being front wheel drive. A lot of the things that make things what they are is flaws.
Yep.
Are we going to lose that as we learn and move into machine learning for engineering? Are we going to lose the mistakes that human beings make and the characteristics that become so endearing about some of these flawed vehicles disappear?
Yes. I'll say.
No, that's so sad.
I think we're already losing it. I think that, you know, I think that the homogenization of modern cars. I fucking hate modern cars, man. There's nothing that I want to spend my money on. You know, yes, all right, buy a fucking Cadillac. What's it called? The Blackwing or whatever. Like, yeah, maybe that's an absolute fucking road burning machine, but it's expensive and it's complex and it's big and heavy. And I've looked at it. I do a 50-mile commute on the 405 now, and I'm like, what? I've got a Ram RT that I drive up on the freeway, and I'm trying to figure out what my daily should be. And do I just give up and buy a fridge? You know, do I buy a new Prius? It's not a bad looking car, to be honest.
I know. I've thought about it too, man. Cause I'm just like, if I have to own something new that's reliable for the wife, why don't I just get the thing?
But then I'm like, if you're gonna go out and spend $60,000, why don't you buy a super high miler 80s Carrera that's been looked after, because 60-70 grand will buy you one of those if it's high mile.
Yeah.
Or even better, like a super high miler like 996 turbo, right? Like, that car's not going to go down in value. And you get to the point where high milers, where you put more miles on it, and it almost increases in value because it suddenly becomes like the quarter-million-mile Porsche that everyone wants to talk about.
Right.
So,
yeah, but at the same time, those cars are not – I mean, that from an enthusiast perspective, that's an option. But for the regular person, they're stuck with this design where everything looks like an egg – or some sort of sneaker with the Velcro straps.
The sad thing about the human race is the average person doesn't give a shit. The average person just wants to get on with their lives and everything's easy. They don't want to have to work hard at anything. I count myself lucky to be not that person, but at the same time, my life is fraught with pain and stress. Everything that I do, right? Everything I do, nothing works. Everything breaks down. I've got to fix the coffee maker, man, because I like the old one. Got rather than the cheapened new one. And you know, but I think in general, I'm happy for those people to enjoy their Tesla Model 3s and their Priuses and whatever the fuck, right?
But are they? What are they enjoying? If everybody's not fixing their coffee maker and they're not living through some sort of misery, how are they enjoying anything?
You honestly, the glee, I spoke to a perfectly intelligent human being at a party on Saturday night who the glee he expressed at being able to take his hands off the wheel in his Tesla and have a chat with his girlfriend was like mind blowing. Like, he was so excited about that. He loved it. The fact that he didn't actually have to drive his car anymore. And he was a perfectly rational human. I'm kind of like, you know,
can we judge that guy though and go, is that real happiness?
I can judge him when he crashes under a semi and
you know, he's decapitated. Yeah. I'm just saying, can we say potentially that, yeah, that guy is an intelligent, regular dude. Like, I met a girl the other day who was taking pictures with a car, and they rented a car for an event, and they didn't rent one of the cars because the woman thought the rotors were too big and would ruin the photos. And she didn't know, she did not even know what they were for.
Right.
You know, and these are the type of people that are being like, yeah, I love this. I don't have to drive the car. This is great. It makes me so happy. But that's not happy.
The bit that makes me less happy than that, like, I'm happy. I am perfectly happy for families to go out in a big, safe box and feel happy and not have to worry. Sure. Right, right. So I'm down with that, right? I'm down with 100%. I'm down with 60% of the population who just want something safe that they don't have to worry about, and it gets them there. Down with that, dude. Understand it. The thing that I'm not down with, if I'm really honest, in modern car world, is the arms race of not even supercars anymore, but this arms race of luxury automobiles that are fucking awful to drive. They leave you completely removed from the real sensation of driving, even though they pretend to be like, yeah, this is the, if you're rich enough to have this, then you're a real enthusiast, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is Emperor's new clothes, man. These cars are not exciting to drive. They may be, you might get a thrill of watching the world whip by faster than you could ever believe you can travel. But, like, we always used to joke about it at Hack Rod that we wanted, like, slow car skinny tires, far more fun, right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing that, even though I'm technically in the salary band where I could go out and buy an expensive, like, super weapon for the 405, it just leaves me cold. I would rather drive something that I feel connected. I just sold my S4. I had a 2008 S4 Avant, 6-speed.
Yeah.
And I made the choice to sell it because it was either, I could either put 10 grand in my pocket or I could spend 10 grand on the car. And I just looked at everything I've got in my life, and I looked at what was in the driveway, and I want to take my kid to Europe this summer. And I was like, you know what? Too many projects. I'd rather put that 10 grand into my Porsche to get it on the road faster. And I sold my Audi, and I immediately regretted it because I was like, holy shit, that car, while technically a little bit beyond what I would call like peak car, it was still, it was a manual transmission V8 wagon that was small to park, no problem at all. Great visibility out of all four corners.
Yep.
Fast as fuck. Really as fast as you really need any car to go, let's be honest. And also truly unique, like you never see them. And people would compliment it all the time. And now I sit around having made that fatal mistake. I always do this, by the way. I have a really good car, and then I sell it on a whim, and then I'm like, fuck.
I've done that like 75 times.
My 964. I'm gonna get a 964 again. I bought that car from an old woman in the neighborhood for $8,000, and it was a rare color, and it was just manual, and it had a blue leather interior, and I sold it for 40 and thought I'd done well, and I'll never get another one again because, you know. But now I'm like, well, fuck, what do I get?
Like, every car is a luxury car, man. That's the problem, is there's no breadth. If you look at a Hyundai, it's got all the same features as a brand new Mercedes. Yeah. It's all the same. It's just the fit and finish and design is different. But, you know, back in the day, if you look at this car, this is a 72. And I also at one point had a 73 Pinto. Right. The breadth of design, execution, features between this car and a fucking Pinto was massive. The carburation, the brakes, everything.
There was a car for every taste. I've got a 73 Superbug parked out in the driveway that's like, I just got it for fun. I bought it on a whim. I've got to finish it and sell it because I don't need it on the driveway. But like 73 Superbug versus a 73 Ford of any kind from any side of the world, chalk and cheese, right? Mm-hmm. Still, even though the Bug had actually been in production since the 40s, the Superbug with its curved glass, and it still felt like a modern car compared to, you get in a 73 Ford Escort, and it's like a tin box on wheels, unless you get it like a fast one. It's literally a biscuit tin on wheels, right?
Yeah.
Whereas you get in the Bug and you pull the door and it's like clunk.
Yeah.
And like back in the day, there was a car for every personality. There was a car for every taste.
Let's be more vague or more general about this. What is design? What are people designing for now? Because I don't think this concept is just cars. I don't think it is. I think it's appliances, it's cars, it's building, it's urban design, it's transportation.
My honesty, I believe the designer for profit. I believe that the homogenization of gradually everything gets, if you whittle everything down to the lowest common scent, then inevitably you find there's two things happen, right? You find common platforms and technologies that allow you to engineer things cheaply and efficiently. You also end up, I think we talked about this last time, man, like you end up with a world where nobody wants to take a chance. Uh-huh. Take a chance on design and style, then there's a chance that you will sell 10% less cars than your competition, and then the shareholders and the analysts will fire your ass.
Yeah.
And so you end up with this homogenized world where every fucking car looks the same, that everyone, if you don't put a high-shouldered rear window on your SUV with a funny kick in the rear, then there's a chance that you will sell less because people might really like that. And they might not like the different shape you put on your car. And that's the sad fact of it, man. It's a natural race in all industries when you eventually end up led by profit, which you do. It's a sad part of capitalism that eventually the shareholders want their money every fucking year. And if you don't give it to them, then you don't have a job. And eventually people stop being agents of change and stop being risk takers. You know,
the Soviets weren't making great cars either. If you could even get one, let's be honest.
Oh well, then there's a whole different thing that goes back to leadership, right? Setting up a culture where nobody questions the man above them, because you could say this. You could say this thing about China up until about like 10 years ago, and in fact, you could probably say the same thing about China now. Same deal, dude. Same, hierarchical mentality when it comes to leadership. You're going to do what you're told. And if you've got a better idea than me, you better keep your mouth shut because I'm the boss. And yeah. I think that what you saw in Russia and in China when it came to industry was quite often, we're going to keep all of the money for the state. You're going to engineer things cheaply. People don't need more than the bare minimum, and don't question that. And if you're a guy who thinks that if you could maybe add a stereo and some better seats to that car and maybe sell twice as many, we don't want to hear about it because you're the subservient, comrade, employee, proletariat, and you just keep your mouth shut and do what we say because we don't really care because we just want to keep all the money for ourselves anyway.
It's weird. Both sides of the middle ground are very steep.
Yeah.
You know, if you're standing on the middle ground and you're in between these two extremes, it's a long way down and it's a quick way down to either side.
Yeah. One of my favorite, and I'll take this to the grave because it's absolutely true, right? One of my favorite management phrases, and I can't really remember where I learned it, is that A-grade people hire A-grade people. B-grade people hire C-grade people, right? And the difference in putting that into management terms, if you're confident in what you do, if you understand that the strength of your team makes you good, you will always hire the best person you can. And your job in that world as a manager is to make yourself redundant, is to make your team so fucking good that you don't have anything to do all day. And the little bit of self-confidence in that is that if you do that, generally, you'll move up the ladder anyway, right? B-grade people hire C-grade because B-grade people want yes men. And they don't want someone as good as them or someone who's better than them working for them because they're insecure.
They're managing out of fear.
And they're managing out of fear. They want a guy who's always going to do what he's told. He's never going to question them. And to me, it's my favorite kind of management mantra when it comes to like organizational development and all the rest of it. There's probably tons of people here, there's tons of people I know in my world who like wouldn't really appreciate me saying it. I'm certainly not going to name any names, but that's my attitude to it. The thing that I have always, I don't give a fuck, man. I'll go and buy a farmhouse and paint paintings for the rest of my life. But when I go to work, I always carry that with me. I'm like, you know what? I want the people beneath me to be as good as they possibly can be, because I want them to do well, because the company will do well if they're doing well, and hopefully I'll do well if my team's doing well.
Who's got the quote that says, basically, there's no limit to how far you can go if you let everybody else take the credit?
I know the intent of the quote. I don't know the quote.
Yeah, the intent of it.
100%, right? That if you are, and I come across people all the time who are incredibly successful, but they're also fucking B-grade managers and they just want the credit for themselves, or they cannot stand behind you in a conversation. They have to stand in front of you. And, you know, My job when I go to work, and that's what I'm doing now with Relativity, hopefully, is teaching people to trust in their employees and then giving people the process and the honest process and the honest systems to work within where they can excel, right? Where
is that what you mean when you say altruistic leader?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. 100%. I've got my own little slice of ego when it comes to this stuff, right? Like you want me to go and stand and talk to people about my paintings? That's all me, Sunshine, nobody else involved. But when I go to work for a company, there's no single hero in a company. Nobody makes a brand. It's everybody, right? And so if you're going to be a leader, your job there is to bring everybody along. And so when I say altruistic leader, that's what it's all about, right? Lead from behind. Put your people first. Did I always do it? No. Did I make mistakes when I was at Hot Wheels and maybe push myself in front of the camera more? Probably. And I'm happy to admit that. You know, I'm happy to learn from where I didn't really kind of live the mantra. But I think also a lot of this is coming, you know, I left Hot Wheels when I was 40 and I'm 50 now, and I've done a lot of other crazy shit, and I've put my life on the line, not my life on the line, but my livelihood on the line. Mm-hmm. And I've burnt it all down and learned from that. Right. And so I think a lot of this comes from the 10 years of reflection. I like to think that at Hot Wheels, I was a much loved leader, and I certainly with my team, I think I was, and I, actually not just my team. I think I was maybe a threat to some people, and I think other people were working with me. But
sounds like you deserve a car that runs.
I need a car that runs, dude.
You need a car. You need a car. What are you looking for? Like, what do you want? Like, last time we talked, you didn't have a car either. But what are you looking for? What are you waiting for? Because you could get something. What's going on?
So I'm a single dad, and this summer is camp summer.
How old is your kid?
She's 9 and a half.
Oh, same as me.
I bought my single cab Ram so that she could travel in the front seat with me. Like, she's my co-pilot. Yeah. And I loved it until we got to having to do some kind of ride sharing with parents to drop kids off at camp. And now I'm the dad who's got only one seat in his dumb truck. As much as I want to buy like a really bitching sports car to drive to work, I realize I probably need a family wagon of some sort.
Yeah.
And at the moment, I could probably get away with a 911 for a couple of years. The kids will still fit in the back and think.
Like a manual Audi wagon would be dope right now.
I wish I had one of them. but then I've also got this need to like turn up at my friends' rallies. And all too often, whether it's Overcrest or whether it's Robin's rally, like all too many times it's been, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it this year because I don't have anything to drive.
That's a good excuse, honestly. I mean, from all the other excuses I've heard, that one's pretty good. I don't have a car. Well, fuck, yeah. I guess that one's good. That works.
I guess I'm not sure. And by the way, I'm not a good passenger, so I have been offered rides, and I'm like, yeah.
Oh, yeah, me either. I'm not good. I'm like hands on the dashboard. I can't do it.
Doesn't matter how good the driver is. Doesn't matter how much track time I'm like, no, sorry, dude. Like if I'm gonna go off a cliff, it's gonna be with my hands on my wheel.
Yeah, I've ridden with some incredible drivers and they still scare me. I don't know. I just can't. It's like the physics of it. I just can't. Everything's coming too fast. Yeah. I just can't do it.
It always goes wrong. Inevitably you can't drive like that on public roads and without something going wrong at some point, man. It's just the way it goes, you know.
We've got
friends to prove that.
So you've got something coming out pretty soon that's going to be on Bring a Trailer. Can you tell us what it is? What you got cooking?
So I've got a piece that was actually ready to list on Bring a Trailer, and then the Luftgehold auction got in the way, so I pulled it. And so hopefully it'll go up sometime this week. And it's actually a piece that it's probably the biggest piece I've ever sold. I started it. I had a canvas lying in the studio, and I just started painting it for fun because in my head, I've got a 70T that's going to be a total hot rod, and at one point it was definitely going to be purple, and I had the whole scheme of purple with a smiley face on one of the spots in my head, and so I started painting this painting of a purple hot rod white arch 911 with a smiley face. And it kind of took off and became this piece that it's hung around, and I painted it in like 3 or 4 stages, and it's got because it was just a sketch, I never worried about the composition, and then realized it had this big gap on it, and I needed to put something. And eventually, I was like, I'm going to put a slogan, And then my buddy Ward Robinson, I don't know if you've ever met Ward, but he, when I first met him, he drove a 80s Carrera. I can't remember exactly what year it was. And it was when we were all into driving. We were all learning about driving early 911s. And Ward always drove barefoot. And he had "don't lift" tattooed on his right foot. I said, which is a good mantra for anyone who drives a 911 fast. Yeah. And so it just came to me one night. It's like, oh, fuck, yeah, don't lift. And yeah, so I did the first kind of like slogan piece.
Okay. And what size is that? You said it was big. What are we talking?
I think it's like, I want to say it is 40 by 60.
Okay. Maybe.
It's a big canvas, 40 inches by 60. And it's really, it's a great, like, it works whether you want something for your garage wall, or you want a big like piece of graffiti for your house, or if you want like a, you know, a slogan for life in your boardroom. So I'm hoping it does well.
Yeah.
And it's actually a piece that it's hung around for a long time, and I've worked on it like over the past 2 years, and I pulled it out from storage to get ready to sell it. And then realized actually it's fucking dope. Like, I really like it. It's one of my favorite pieces.
Awesome.
I have to hang art on the wall for quite some time, or even hide it away before I can really look at it with fresh eyes. And so I'm quite excited about it. I think it's a popular. I've done prints of it, and I've sold quite a few prints of that piece because it's such a kind of mantra for life in a way. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I don't know. Hopefully this week it'll go up. Maybe next week.
We'll keep an eye out for it, dude. I can't wait to see you in person again. I can't thank you enough for spending time with me today. I was really looking forward to talking about leadership, and it didn't disappoint. Thank you so much for hanging out.
Yeah, cheers, Chris. I look forward to the next kind of beers and couch session after some car show somewhere.
We'll have to figure something out.
Damn right.
All right, take care of yourself, man.
Take care.
Bye-bye.